Hi, I'm Bill Kristol. Welcome to Conversations. I'm pleased to have back today my good friend, Eric Edelman, a longtime Foreign Service officer, culminating in ambassadorships to a couple of countries, one of them Turkey, a complicated tenure, which we discussed, I think, in an earlier conversation. Eric then served at the end of at the last 3.5 years of the Bush administration as number three person in the Defense Department, a very senior position where he was involved in all kinds of every policy matter, really. And we've had conversations before, Eric, on in which you've sort of done an excellent job, I think, of sort of helping us think about foreign policy broadly and the challenges we face and covering the waterfront, tour d'horizon, sort of. But today we're going to focus on one topic, which is very much in the news, Afghanistan, which you've obviously been very involved in that policy too for a couple of decades and commented on it. So today, just to locate people, is July 8th, the withdrawal from Afghanistan is near to complete. We read this morning. So anyway, Eric, thank you for joining me.
Bill, it's always great to be with you.
I don't know that it's going to be our most upbeat discussion, but I think it's an important one and one that hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves. Do you think it's a pretty momentous decision simply to pull out of, and apart from people saying, well, it's been a long time and it was going to happen anyway. And it hasn't really, I don't know, from my point of view, it's been surprising how little coverage it's really gotten. And then people haven't, and this is what we'll do today, I think, thought through the implications of what may well happen.
No, I very much agree. I would say that in the first 6 months of the Biden administration, this is probably the most consequential thing in international affairs that Biden has done. I mean, there are a couple of other candidates in there, but right now this looks like the most important thing. And I agree with you. I think it hasn't gotten as much attention as it deserves. And I don't think either the administration, you know, or the commentariat has done a very good job of really thinking through a lot of the second or third order consequences, because much of the punditry and commentary has just been focused on, you know, ending endless wars, which is really a kind of mindless way to look at this whole problem.
Yeah, that's a big statement and an interesting one, though, that it could be the most consequential decision. I don't think that's. Well, let's hope it all works out, but I worry that it's both consequential and damaging. So let's talk about that. I mean, what? Why did President Biden make the decision? Well, give us a little bit of the backdrop of that. Obviously, we all know why we intervened in the first place and the ups and downs of the war to some degree. Vice President Biden came into office as vice president. President Biden came into office as vice president in January of 2009, and there was a on the heels of some policy reviews, I think you were involved in one of them very directly, on what we should do in Afghanistan and the Obama administration in order to surge our troops in its first year in Afghanistan.
Yeah, there is a long backstory to this. Obviously, this has been America's longest war. We've been at it for 20 years, which is very atypical for Americans. You know, George Marshall famously said that Americans can only fight wars for 4 years. We've obviously done, you know, longer than that in Afghanistan. I think one thing that's really important to remember as you think about all of this is the degree of difficulty we took on when we intervened in Afghanistan. During the initial operations in 2001, when I was working in the White House for then Vice President Cheney, John Abizaid, who was the deputy CENTCOM commander, famously said in a play on words on something that Curtis LeMay had said about Vietnam, when he said, "We're going to bomb Vietnam back into Stone Age," that John Abizaid said, "We're going to bomb Afghanistan forward into the Stone Age." And I think we forget that Afghanistan, when we entered the country in 2001, had been subject to 20 years of war and violence going back to the Soviet invasion in 1979. You know, people hadn't gone to school for, two generations. So the country was almost totally illiterate. The per capita GDP of Afghanistan today is $500, roughly $500 a year, according to World Bank data. Just to give you a comparative, Haiti, which is the poorest country in our hemisphere, and we, people are focusing on Haiti because of the assassination of the president yesterday, or the day before. The GDP of Haiti is $1,200 a year. So Afghanistan is, you know, about a third of that. So this was always going to be a long, complicated story, not to mention the fact that the country itself's got a complicated ethnic makeup, divided among, you know, ethnic groups, and the geography is very forbidding. So it was the degree of difficulty, since the Olympics are coming up, you know, if this were Olympic diving, the degree of difficulty here would have been very great. In 2008-09, as you mentioned, during the transition from the Bush to the Obama administrations, there were three reviews that were undertaken about what to do about Afghanistan. One was led by Lieutenant General Doug Lute, who was working at the White House and actually transitioned from the Bush to the Obama administrations, where he continued to serve, and Megan O'Sullivan, who was the Deputy National Security Advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan. And that was one review. General David Petraeus, who was then the CENTCOM commander, conducted his own review, and the incoming Obama team under Michelle Flournoy and the late Richard Holbrooke conducted a third review. And they all came to pretty much the same conclusion, which is that we ought to have a fully resourced counterinsurgency strategy, something akin to what we did in the surge in Iraq in 2007 and 8, which had been quite successful in reducing the violence and diminishing the threat from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Afghanistan. And President Obama approved that, although then Vice President Biden was a dissenter in that debate. We can come back and talk a little bit about that, because I do think it speaks to the decisions he's made recently. And President Obama did agree to a surge, but I think, unfortunately, he time limited it. He said the surge would always be limited to, I think, about 18 months, and then we would draw down and then we would get out. And this sort of played, I think, into the hands of the Taliban, who famously always say that, you know, the West has the watches, but we have the time, and it allowed them to, you know, to wait out the United States and its NATO allies who were supporting the Afghan government and the national security forces of Afghanistan. Then Vice President Biden at the time opposed the counterinsurgency approach and advocated a counterterrorism strategy, which would have had a much lighter footprint, something actually much closer to what the late Donald Rumsfeld had kind of advocated, with a explicitly counterterrorism mission, and would have left to the Afghans dealing with the Taliban insurgency.
I mean, I would just add two things, and you can comment on them and take the story forward too. And of course, Afghanistan was the good war from the point of view of the President Obama and the Obama administration, the necessary war. We had no choice after 9/11, and had gone well for a while, then difficult, but not like Iraq, obviously, in terms of the deaths, the commitment of manpower, our own deaths, civilian deaths, and so forth. And so it was, and the surge in Iraq had succeeded pretty well. Right. And for all the people like me were critical, I was supported the surge. I remember being invited to the White House in a bipartisan meeting, you know, with the president, where I think he was a little nervous to see people like me supporting it, but he had his own doubts about it. It wasn't kind of what he wanted to do, but I think to his credit, he did what he thought was the right thing for the country. And for all the time limiting of it, which I think was a mistake, and the subsequent difficulties, which God knows there've been plenty of, and I mean, the truth is, if you had told us, correct me if I'm wrong, in 2009-10, that in 2020-21, we would have the situation we have in Afghanistan, which is, or we had until, let's say, 6 months ago, a messy situation, not great, a lot of Taliban hasn't gone away, they don't have perfect control, the government's not free of corruption, et cetera, but basically limited violence, very little engagement on the part of U.S. troops, a pretty successful drawdown. People like us might have said maybe too much drawdown, but a pretty successful drawdown to a few thousand troops, not mostly thankfully engaged in combat, or certainly not taking fatalities when they, you know, the kind of combat they were engaged in. I think one would have said, you know what, that's not a bad, I mean, I hate to, this is so contrary, and I'm almost scared to say this, but this was not such a bad decade, right? I mean, if you look, sort of step back and say, you know, as a matter of foreign policy, you kept a country that had been the seedbed of terror directed against us and others from being such a thing. You had kept reasonable stability in the region when everyone was very worried about Pakistan and other places 10 years ago. We'll come back to that going forward. And the way which everyone just regards the war as a ridiculous, hopeless enterprise, they forgot that it was the good war. They forgot that it was not unsuccessful, the things we did there to some degree. And now, I guess President Obama's inclination to want to get out, though he never quite did, and President Trump's repeated attempts to get out, somehow 10 years of that has just convinced a pretty good chunk of the American people and laid the groundwork, I guess, for incoming President Biden to just say enough.
Look, this has been a very frustrating, 20-year experience for Americans. H.R. McMaster, who served out in Afghanistan, and of course was President Trump's second national security advisor, has said, and I think there's some merit in this, that it wasn't really a 20-year war. It was, 21-year wars, because we, changed approaches, changed commanders, rotated forces. And there's a lot of lessons that, appropriately need to be drawn, eventually from this experience. But there were, a lot of successes, both in terms of, recreating an education system, getting Afghans back to school, particularly girls and women. Great gains for women's rights. The corruption, of course, has been a persistent problem and very frustrating one for Americans to deal with. I mean, we contributed to that because of the flood of international assistance money that came into Afghanistan, which distorted the economy and created a lot of perverse incentives. So it's been a long, frustrating process. But as you, I think, rightly suggest, first, President Obama, to his credit, did not carry through on his undertaking to withdraw all U.S. forces before he left. There was persistent pressure from folks in the Pentagon in particular to make withdrawals conditions based. President Trump came in and wanted to get out again, just as President Obama had wanted to do. And he was to some degree thwarted again by the Pentagon, by H.R. McMaster and others who wanted to make sure that, we didn't leave with our tail between our legs and that we didn't accept a defeat in Afghanistan. And we had kind of come to, an outcome that wasn't terribly satisfactory from a lot of points of view, but which was tolerable, which was the presence of about, 3,000, 3,500 troops, not in combat, as you said, mostly providing support and enablement for the Afghan security forces to be able to carry out the military tasks. The Afghans were bearing the brunt of the fighting. U.S. casualties were almost non-existent or very, very low. I think 4 killed, in the year before President Trump started this process of withdrawal. And I think, this is going to be seen in retrospect, I fear, as, a self-inflicted, unforced error on the part of the United States. Now, to be fair to the Biden administration, it was President Trump who decided to first negotiate an agreement with the Taliban, and then to not only agree to withdraw by May 1st of this year, but actually to try and accelerate that withdrawal. He was trying to get it done before he left office. And that, of course, got subsumed in the post-election issues of him trying to stay in office. And
say a word about that, because I have the impression that the Afghanistan issue was more than some of us realize, kind of a key issue in Trump's arguments with the Defense Department and his actions there.
Yeah, absolutely, they were. I mean, as you know, Mark Esper, who was the Secretary of Defense, Trump's last Secretary of Defense, well, not last because he appointed an acting, but the last confirmed Secretary of Defense, was fired the day after the election. And I have pretty good reason to believe from discussions with him that a big part of his firing in his mind had to do with is resisting Trump's effort to accelerate the withdrawal. And of course, part of the rationale that he and others in the Pentagon used for resisting the withdrawal was that the Taliban wasn't living up to the terms of the agreement. Yes, they weren't attacking U.S. forces, which was part of their agreement, but they weren't negotiating in good faith with the Afghan government. People were rightly concerned that accelerating the withdrawal would carry all sorts of broader repercussions for the region, for the safety of U.S. forces as we withdrew, et cetera. And so, you know, shortly before he was fired, Secretary Esper sent a memo to President Trump outlining six or seven reasons why the withdrawal shouldn't be accelerated and pushed forward. I'm pretty sure that he believes that was one of the major reasons, not the only one, but one of the major reasons for which President Trump fired him.
It wouldn't be unfair to call this the Trump-Biden withdrawal. Right? I mean, Biden, in this respect, carried through maybe in a slightly less Trumpy way in terms of rhetoric and decision making, but carried through on what President Trump had wanted to do. And to be fair, what Biden himself presumably had said he would do in the campaign of 2020. I mean, we had a campaign which both candidates were committed to withdrawal. So I suppose in some ways, people like us shouldn't be surprised by it.
Well, that's correct. And, the Biden administration, people who've been discussing this on background with press and whatnot, have pointed out repeatedly to the fact that the United States under President Trump was committed to withdraw by May 1st of 2021 under this agreement. Now, as I just said, they had plenty of reason, had they wanted to stay, to say, well, you know, the Taliban's not living up to this agreement, so therefore we're not bound by the withdrawal deadline. In fact, they postponed the withdrawal past May 1st, obviously. We're now in July, as you noted. And President Biden, when he made his announcement, set the final withdrawal deadline of September 11th this year. And now we're almost 90% or so complete with the withdrawal. I think we're now down to a very small force of under 1,000 troops and some contractors who are maintaining embassy security and also helping Kabul Airport remain open after the United States has withdrawn from Bagram Airport or air base. And some of those folks may end up staying a little bit longer as part of the effort to help the Turks who have volunteered to try and keep the airport open in Kabul. And so some of them may stay on even beyond September 11th, I suspect, as part of that arrangement, although that has yet to be worked out. So the administration basically is taking the position that we were obligated to do this because the United States under President Trump had agreed to do this. There's a parallel here, of course, to Iraq. And it's a parallel that is, I think, unfortunately, not one that makes me very hopeful about, the future of Afghanistan. When the Bush administration turned over Iraq to the Obama administration, we had just completed in November of 2008 a status of forces agreement and a strategic framework agreement with the government of Iraq, which said that all U.S. forces would be withdrawn by December 31st, 2011. The broad understanding, and this is not just me saying this, Ryan Crocker, who was then our ambassador, and Dave Petraeus, who was the commanding general in Iraq at the time that this was negotiated, have all said on the record that there was a broad understanding that although we had reached this agreement, that it would be very difficult for the government of Iraq to actually take responsibility for security, by January 1st, 2012, which of course put it right into our election season. But the Obama administration ultimately, and this was very much driven by President Obama, because I think others in the administration recognized that, this agreement had been done to placate the Council of Representatives in Baghdad, but that the Ministry of Defense and Interior were counting on the United States staying on past the December 31st, 2011 deadline. In fact, the Minister of Defense came here in the spring of 2009 and, you know, got conflicting signals actually from people in the administration. Some people saying we're out of there on December 31st, 2011, and others saying, well, no, maybe we can work something out. You know, in the end of the day, they didn't work anything out. The U.S. withdrew. And the consequence was that within 3 years, you had the crumbling of Iraqi security forces, the rise of the Islamic State and the creation of a caliphate in parts of Syria and Iraq, and a requirement for U.S. forces to go back in order to help the Iraqis defeat the caliphate in Iraq and Syria, which took an additional 3 years, was completed in late 2017 under President Trump. So there's a parallel here, obviously. You know, it's not unknown for administrations to, you know, blame their predecessors for decisions that they have to, unpopular decisions they have to take, or decisions that they might not take otherwise. But, you know, this is now being laid at the doorstep of the Trump administration with some justice, but it doesn't mean that they had to do it. This was a choice to carry on this this agreement, given the fact that the Taliban's been violating.
President Biden has pretty much embraced the choice. I mean, he campaigned on it, and he's not boasting about it. That's not quite fair, but he's not walking away from it at all. So, yeah. And I guess they'll do certain things to stop what happened in the next few years. And the 2011 withdrawal coincided with our failure to do much to after the Arab Spring to help friends in the region. Of course, the failure to intervene in Syria, altogether, you know, a pretty disastrous next 3, 4, 5 years in that region. Massive refugee flows, migration, destabilization of other parts of Europe. In fact, I mean, slaughter of people in Syria, and of course in Iraq itself, the rise of ISIS, the killing of Americans and Westerners. I mean, the whole thing, I've always thought 2011 is underrated as a kind of hinge year where things really, you know, went bad for the next several years, and we still haven't fully recovered from that. Anyway, but let's talk about Afghanistan, I guess. So let's assume President Biden's not going to change his mind, and maybe it's just too late given how many troops are now out, and we've, you know, I'm not sure Bagram can't just go back in and so forth. So what happens? I mean, what are the, why are people like you and me worried about this apart? You know, why isn't this going to be, it'll be a mess, and, you know, there'll be some nasty things that happen on the ground, but at the end of the day, you know, 20 years was enough, and the world's a difficult place, and let's be realistic, and, you know, and let's focus on China and the big power threats and all this. What will happen in your judgment?
First, I think the Biden administration is counting on public opinion essentially being with them on this. Yeah. And obviously there's a lot of frustration about, you know, the war and the part of the public. The likelihood is, you know, you've now started to see intelligence assessments suggesting that, you know, the regime could actually collapse, you know, within 6 months. I mean, I think people had originally thought it might be longer, and it might be longer. The truth is, we have no idea. It's extremely worrisome that the Taliban has taken over just in the last few weeks, you know, about 10% of the district capitals in Afghanistan, including in a lot of places where traditionally the Taliban hasn't been particularly strong. I mean, the Taliban is a Pashtun-based insurgency that is strongest in the southern part of the country. They've been operating in northern parts of the country with great effect, which is a bit of a surprise to some people. They've also taken control of a important customs post on the Afghan border with Tajikistan. And I don't think people appreciate enough the degree to which the government of Afghanistan as a going concern relies on customs duties as a huge part of its revenues. I mean, there's very little else that generates revenue in the country. As I said, you know, it's got a per capita income of $500 a year. So you're not going to get a lot of tax, you know, revenue out of that. So it's transit trade and the customs duties associated with it that fund a lot of government services. So Taliban taking this over is worrisome on two scores. One, it gives them money to fuel their own their own operations, and they're taking over, as they've taken over these district capitals, they're getting a lot of U.S. equipment that was left with the Afghan security forces, many of whom are fleeing across the border themselves, leaving their equipment behind. But it also starves the Afghan government of being able to, operate and provide services, which is a crucial part of their ability to maintain their legitimacy and any support from the populace. So it's already, I think, a very worrisome circumstance. And certainly, I would hope that they can sustain themselves for some period of time. But this could unravel much more rapidly, I fear, than some people think. A lot of people point to the Najibullah government, which lasted for several years after the Soviets withdrew, much to the surprise of our own Central Intelligence Agency, which had a dog in the fight, so to speak, since they had been involved in attempting to remove the Afghan regime. But I think it could happen more quickly, than that. And one of the things that I wouldn't say it's shocking, but one of the things that is surprising, given the fact that the Biden administration has stressed so much that it's bringing back due, sort of deliberative process to the interagency structures of government, that they're got regular order in their meetings of principals and deputies committees, et cetera, that this decision seems to have been made and announced without a lot of the downstream consequences being factored in. So, for instance, at the time that President Biden announced the decision, the Pentagon said that, we'll continue to support the Afghans, from outside of Afghanistan. But there is no plan yet, and nobody in the Pentagon or in the Biden administration can answer the question of where will U.S., forces be based. Central Asia is likely to be a problem, and we used to have bases in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. We've pulled out of those bases over the years. But as our relations with Russia have soured since 2014, those countries are very much subject to influence from Vladimir Putin. And it's very unlikely that Putin's going to do us any favors smile on U.S. forces being in Tajikistan or Kyrgyzstan or Uzbekistan, where they would be nearby. So we're going to have to operate from much, much further away. And Frank McKenzie, the commander of CENTCOM, has said that we can fly some of these missions, from the Gulf countries where we're based. But those are very long flights. They need refueling. And it's not impossible, as he put it, but it isn't easy either. And so particularly if you're talking about timely, air support. And withdrawing the contractors from Afghanistan is a particularly large problem, because those contractors are what keep Afghan rotary wing and to the degree that there's fixed wing aircraft in the air, providing air support for the Afghan National Security Forces. So there have been a lot of questions about how all this is going to work that I don't think really have been completely thought through and worked out. I mean, that's kind of one level.
I mean, that one sense is that they kind of think, I suppose, President Biden, look, it's going to unravel gradually or maybe a little more quickly. There'll be problems. There'll be humanitarian disasters and the like. But at the end of the day, we can contain the actual terrorism threat, maybe on this in a long range way with drones and all this. And there's a limit to what we can do for the Afghan people. And it's too bad, I suppose they would say, but and they'll hope for the best and whatever. But is it really a fundamental threat to us, to our allies, to geopolitical stability, or is it just something we have to sort of swallow hard and put up with? That's kind of the sophisticated, I would say, realist view that acknowledges that things aren't going to be great over there, but hopes they're not terrible, but especially hopes the consequences aren't very fundamental. So it just becomes kind of a unpleasant aspect of a consequence of one particular decision.
I think you're right, and I think this may be a miscalculation. I mentioned earlier that I thought that the Biden administration is counting on the fact that the public's quite fatigued with being in Afghanistan, that the likely reaction of many Americans when this, if and when this does unravel, we start to see scenes of Taliban violence against women and girls and human rights violations and refugee flows, that people will say, well, you know, this just shows we shouldn't have been there in the first place, because, you know, after 20 years, if the Afghans, you know, can't fight for themselves, why, you know, why should we be there to fight for them? In fact, some members of the administration have already articulated this in podcasts and background comments, you know, et cetera. I think that might be a miscalculation, because while the public's first blush reaction may be that, it's, you know, sober second thought may be something else. And in particular, if the terrorist threat starts to recreate itself more rapidly than we anticipate, and if the whole thing unravels very rapidly, it's very possible that the terrorist threat could, become greater once again. Now, it may be a while before it immediately threatens attacks on the homeland, as it did on 9/11, but you could see, you know, other phenomena. So, for instance, we talked about what happened in Iraq between and Syria between 2011 and 2014. You know, according to Pew data, the most noted foreign policy story for the American public since 9/11 was the beheading of James Foley, the American journalist, by the Islamic State. And it was largely that and a couple of associated acts of terror by the Islamic State that ultimately drove the Obama administration, you know, back into Iraq and back into taking action to get rid of the Islamic State and ultimately deploy forces into, you know, very quietly into Syria. And so I fear that you might see, you know, that happen again. But there is also, you know, broader geopolitical ramifications that I think are potentially quite serious that I'm not sure they have completely thought through again.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because I think you wrote a piece about this for the Bulwark a few weeks ago. I mean, I think that's the one thing I'm so struck by. The whole discussion is takes place as if there's this isolated country, Afghanistan, you pull out, maybe some bad things happen, maybe we need to be, you know, have our guard up on counterterrorism, but it's not connected to anything else in the world, you know. We just get to make this decision, put the forever war behind us, you know, be slightly guilty about what happens on the ground there, take in, I hope we do, of course, many more Afghan translators and people who worked with us, though I can't say the administration has been terribly quick on the draw there either. And then it just kind of is this isolated problem. As if, but talk about that, because that was what you stressed in your piece for the Bulwark.
Yes. And so, first of all, again, there's a history here. You know, the United States, I mean, Afghanistan is a very remote country, but that doesn't mean it's an insignificant country or doesn't have any geopolitical significance. Obviously, the Soviet intervention there in 1979 set off a chain of effects, including the Carter Doctrine, because of concerns that the Soviets might have designs on Iran, where the revolution was immediately underway. Afghanistan is a neighbor of Iran's, of course. You know, the notion that because it's remote and far away, it doesn't have all sorts of potential knock-on effects, I think is quite wrong. Well, first of all, there will be reputational consequences for the United States for being seen to have abandoned an ally. And no matter what people say about, well, it was 20 years and we gave it all we wanted, other allies in Asia will be discomforted, or and partners, not just treaty allies, but take a country like India, for example, which has a lot of concern about what goes on in Afghanistan because of the problems it has with Pakistan and the role that Pakistan plays in Afghanistan, including as providing a safe haven for the Taliban and actually allowing this whole Taliban insurgency, you know, to make a comeback after 2003-04. You know, the Taliban basically was defeated and dispersed and gone from Afghanistan and from 2001 to 2004. We had an election in 2004 that was almost no violence whatsoever. in that election. It was after that that the Taliban insurgency came back, and that was largely a function of the sponsorship of Pakistan and Pakistan providing a safe haven. We tend to forget, you know, you talked about the consequences of inaction in Syria and the role that refugees played in destabilizing European governments and giving rise to, because of migration, uncontrolled migration, and giving rise to a lot of populist movements in Central and Eastern Europe and in Germany because of the fear of waves of migrants. Now, most of them were coming from Syria, but there was no small number of Afghans as well seeking shelter. And if the government does collapse, I think people tend to forget that before Syria, the largest population of refugees we had ever known was 2 million Afghans, most of them sitting in Pakistan after the Soviet invasion in 1979. And of course, those folks became both the Taliban, but also became the petri dish in which Al-Qaeda emerged and ultimately struck the United States. You know, Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, for whom I worked, and I have had multiple discussions about this. You know, we walked away from our involvement, our covert involvement in Afghanistan and forcing the Soviets out in 1992 when the Najib government fell. And we just forgot about Afghanistan and treated it as if it was of no consequence. While we did that, Al-Qaeda was brewing in Afghanistan and planning mass casualty attacks that killed 3,000 of our countrymen on September 11th, 20 years ago. And, you know, it's easy to forget that now because we're at 20 years remove. You know, that's the same remove that between the Pearl Harbor and the inauguration of John Kennedy, if you, you know, want to put it in those kinds of terms. I mean, it gives you a sense of how far removed we are from it. But it doesn't mean that that kind of thing couldn't happen again. But the refugee flow into Pakistan is what concerns me most, because Pakistan is a persistently fragile and failing state. You've got a prime minister currently, Imran Khan, who is basically appears to be encouraging greater Islamicization of the education system after years of people pushing back against that. And, you know, Pakistan already is a nuclear weapon state that has a very large nuclear arsenal and is producing enormous amounts of plutonium. So it's going to have a larger arsenal. Its arsenal already is getting close to the UK's arsenal and could easily outstrip the UK's arsenal. It could easily, it's right now, I think, the fifth largest nuclear weapon state in the world. It could easily become the fourth. And, you know, the collapse of Pakistan with a lot of nuclear warheads around and no US forces nearby to try and secure them should they get loose is something that everybody ought to be worried about, in my view.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's striking, and I've been in one or two war games. This was maybe 10, 12 years ago, actually, when people were much more thinking about this because there had been crises in Pakistan and India-Pakistan, and also India versus Pakistan crises or mini crises, and then we had a lot of troops in Afghanistan, and people were talking about all this more. Yeah, one of the scariest war game scenarios is the, you know, loose nukes in Pakistan scenario, which... And again, you'd think that just in a common sense way, if you have a few thousand troops in Afghanistan, its borders, what, Pakistan, Iran, China, near to Russia, and it things are okay, and it's not contributing, it's not hurting anything, it's not contributing to any weakening of the U.S. in the region, it's not contributing to further migrant flows, and it's not contributing to more radicalization in the region. I don't think you could really make that case. That's pretty, you know, why mess with that? I mean, why risk to what? So we can say we've ended an endless forever war. We pull out our few thousand troops. I mean, I just find it, I understand the impatience and the sort of wish to wash our hands of it. But even if the chances of what we're talking about are 10%, maybe they're more like 20 or 30 or 40, but even if they're 5%, it's such a high risk. It's the risk is so great. And the reward is not so great, it seems to me, and so as you say. But it's funny how, not funny, but it's people don't want to think about that. And there are probably other scenarios we could talk about for a minute too that we haven't even focused on. But the Pakistan one, really, it's a very frustrating, that's a really frustrating country. But, you know, we do not want loose nukes or much more radical, irresponsible government or in Pakistan, or a government that's losing control of its own territory. And therefore there are coups and counter coups and whatever, God knows, right?
And there's also, I mean, you know, given the history of Pakistan's, what one scholar has described to me as its addiction to jihadism as a tool, particularly against India, you know, we've had a couple of very serious incidents between Pakistan and India. You know, we had the Mumbai incident in December of 2008 as we were leaving office in the Bush administration. And we haven't had anything quite like that since then, but it doesn't take much imagination to think that as, you know, Pakistan's problems accumulate, that it might, you know, very easily, you know, choose to provoke some kind of crisis with, you know, with India. That would be something that could lead to bringing these nuclear warheads out of garrison, mating them with weapons, and delegating authority down to the brigade level to use them in the conflict with India. I mean, this is precisely the kind of scenario you were talking about in gaming that, you know, is the most likely route, you know, for something that President Obama said was the, you know, most dangerous threat we faced, which was terrorists getting their hands on nuclear weapons. And thankfully, as you say, it's, you know, it's not a high probability event, I guess I would say. I don't want to say it's a low probability event because it's possible and it's conceivable. And I think as long as it's conceivable, we ought to be trying to put ourselves in a position to keep it from happening, not limiting our options, which is one of the consequences of this decision in Afghanistan.
And the other thing that I think people underrate, and I'm curious what you think about this, is standing in by and watching a genocide or mini genocide or ethnic cleansing or just kind of slaughter, even, you know, more limited ways, happening, especially in a country that we've been involved in so much and for 20 years, it has reputational consequences, but also more direct consequences. I mean, I've always thought that the failure to, in Rwanda, where we had no presence in 1994, so we had nothing comparable in terms of obligation, I think one could say, to Afghanistan. But the fact that that just happened has got to have had an influence on Milosevic's confidence that he can get away with things in Europe. And we know that Assad surviving in Syria, that must have emboldened others, and Putin, I mean, they all look at each other, right? I think Obama's failure to enforce the red line in Syria, I think we have pretty good evidence of this, convinced Putin that, well, he could do what he wanted to some degree in Ukraine and get away with it just to what, less than a year later. So it has pretty, and I just think if you're a dictator thinking of either doing things at home or doing some things in your own near abroad, you'll be emboldened as we do nothing, assuming we don't do much, and terrible things happen to our former people we literally worked with in Afghanistan. I just think it does, unfortunately, embolden the very bad guys and discourage people from taking risks to be on our side or on the side of fighting for decency and freedom in these different parts of the world.
Absolutely. I mean, the argument ad Hitlerum is always suspect, but so I'm going to say this advisedly. But Hitler famously said, when counseled that his persecution of Jews in Germany might, you know, bring down, you know, the condemnation of the international community, he said, "Who remembers the Armenians?" Right. You know, and that was only, you know, some 20 years earlier. Yes, I mean, I think people do look at this, they will see the U.S. standing by. It will be, you know, a pretty awful. And, you know, this decision is sometimes justified in terms of the Middle East in general, but Afghanistan in particular as a distraction. You know, the real long pole in the tent from a strategic point of view is the competition with China. You know, we need to turn our, you know, attention to East Asia. And while there's, of course, an element of truth in all of that, we're not going to get, I mean, you know, 3,500 troops in Afghanistan are not going to give you, first of all, they're not by and large the kind of forces that you need to deal with Indo-Pacific contingencies, first of all. But second of all, you know, the United States abandoning a country that we spent 20 years, trillions of dollars trying to sustain, however justified in terms of the frustrating, you know, nature of the conflict, the failure to have a decisive outcome, whatever people find troubling about it, it will still raise questions in the minds of allies about our staying power and our willingness, you know, to ultimately support them in extremis. It will just be corrosive and eat away, you know, at our alliances. And it will probably force the Biden administration to take some actions that they might not otherwise take in order to reassure allies that we will, you know, be there for them in the event that they get into trouble. And that can have consequences of its own. It may, you know, make things in the competition with China even more complicated.
So let's assume the pullout happens, and let's just for now assume in 2-3 months from now it's not disastrous yet, though it's maybe not great, of course, in Afghanistan. And let's assume even that we are doing what we should be doing in terms of taking in, you know, people who work directly with us. I mean, what would you, and Tony Blinken, Secretary of State, calls you up and says, okay, Eric, maybe we shouldn't have done it, but the president wanted to do it. He was committed to it. He carried through on his campaign promise. But how reparable, what are there obvious things that could be done 3, 6, 9 months from now to kind of mitigate the situation and repair it? Or, I mean, anything obvious that you would urge the interagency process in the Biden administration, now that they've got more staff there than when Biden originally made the decision, to be working on? I
think they really need to try and get, you know, some forces nearby, you know, figure out whether they can get back into Kashi-Khanabad in Uzbekistan, or Manas in Kyrgyzstan, someplace like that. They've got to be closer. I mean, I think already you're seeing signs of how difficult it is, you know, to repair these things. I mean, it's always more expensive to go back in and fix this than it is to, you know, have kept a small, sustainable footprint, which is, I think, where we were kind of had headed, had kind of achieved it, actually. I think it's going to be much harder and more expensive to go back in. And look at the way we left Bagram, which, by the way, you know, even in the putting the best construction on it, you know, seems very unseemly. You know, the Afghan commander says that he didn't know the Americans were gone until 2 hours after they left, and they just turned off the lights. I mean, there seems to have been some looting. It's not clear whether the Americans just took a lot of stuff with them or people got in. You know, this is all obviously being justified on the grounds of operational security because of concerns about you know, the Taliban attacks on U.S. forces. And by the way, I think the Biden administration has been telegraphing the sensitivity to the Taliban attacking U.S. forces, which has, of course, you know, made them even bigger targets, because the Taliban knows if you want to get the Biden administration, you know, to pull out, start attacking U.S. forces, because that's a point of neuralgia and sensitivity for the administration. So, I mean, I think, I mean, I hate to say anything is ever irreparable, because you can always go back in, and we did go back in, and, you know, in Iraq. But I think, you know, if you have to go back in, it's always harder, it's more expensive. You know, it would have been better had you not put yourself in that position.
And for those of us who supported Biden, say you and I did, and hoped it would be a moment of revival of a, you know, traditional, you might say, American foreign policy, where we stand with our allies and use our force to help those fighting for liberty around the world, support democracies, et cetera. And there's been some of that, to be fair, from the Biden administration, and some encouraging signs, I would say, and some bipartisan signs of consensus on standing up to China. This is what I think. In a way, I mean, what worries me the most is really what happens in Afghanistan itself. But what worries me almost as much is the way in which this could undercut an awful lot of that. It would be sort of like, I mean, in Vietnam, I'm not sure the political implications will be that great. I mean, Vietnam was horrible in 75, 76, Cambodia, I mean, you know, slaughter. And I don't know that Ford and Carter talked much about it in the 76 campaign. Both parties were kind of happy. I mean, Ford had tried to do the right thing, I think, in 75, but was so weak he couldn't, and Congress stopped him, and neither party really had much stomach for, you know, campaigning, reversing that. That was after Vietnam, where we had 50,000 American deaths, et cetera. And I suppose President Obama got reelected in 2012 after pulling out of Iraq. It wasn't obvious yet what the consequences of that would be. But so maybe for the next year or 2 years, it's sort of a Trumpy Republican Party is not going to be wildly interventionist either. Now, in the case of Vietnam, it's interesting. Reagan did run and win in 1980, partly on a foreign policy platform, which didn't exactly relitigate Vietnam, but I think it didn't hurt him. I think no one would have predicted this 5 years earlier, that he had been a supporter of the war and a critic of the
all the way through.
You know, yeah, interesting. I mean, even though, and he didn't approve of the way it was fought and all this, but in a way, the country did in 1980 turn to someone who hadn't been part of the withdrawal that, in retrospect, you could say began in maybe 73 or 75, but went on through 79, obviously, until 79, and, you know, in a way, the Iranian Revolution in Afghanistan. So we could have a rough 3 or 4 years. Maybe at the end of it, someone says, you know, yeah, that was a bad path to be on. But I guess, so final question, I guess, yeah, how much... That would be important, it seems to me, for the Biden administration. If they're serious about the broader foreign policy they've articulated and they want to make the case that Afghanistan's kind of a one-off, unique situation, forever war, they need to act in a way that limits the damage there and controls its effects beyond, right? I mean, they can't, but I don't think they can do that just by turning away or by, you know, giving a speech about China or Putin 2 months from now or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you think about the Vietnam analogy, and of course analogies are always tricky and there's lots of differences, but I mean, one of the things that strikes me is, you know, we were actually kind of in a better place in 1973 when the U.S. withdrew from Vietnam than we are actually today in Afghanistan. You know, we had actually, it was too late, but we had actually come upon a counterinsurgency strategy that had actually, you know, ended the Viet Cong insurgency in South Vietnam. And people tend to forget that in 75, when the war ended, it was not the Viet Cong that won. It was the North Vietnamese army. It was main force North Vietnamese troops, you know, coming south who won the war. And you know, having talked to Dr. Kissinger about this, I mean, one of the things he was counting on was continued air support for the government of South Vietnam, and that was cut off by the Congress because the Congress, and it was, I think, really there was pretty much bipartisan support for this in the Congress, you know, had enough of Vietnam. And, you know, it goes back to your earlier question, you know, if things really go to smash and we try to go back in, will Congress actually let that happen? You know, I suspect not. You know, I suspect it will be very hard. So I think the administration will have to try and cauterize the wound and just say, as you just said, this is a one-off. This was a forever war. But now we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And we did do things after 1975. We reinforced the fleet in the Pacific. We made it clear we were going to stay. We refurbished our relations with Japan and other allies in East Asia. And ultimately some... you know, some East Asian leaders like Lee Kuan Yew ultimately came to see Vietnam in a positive light, which is to say, you know, Lee Kuan Yew, the former senior minister in Singapore, basically argued that the U.S. had bought time for the rest of Southeast Asia, you know, to become the economic powerhouse that it had by holding off communism for, you know, some period of years. I'm not sure we're going to have quite that positive an outcome, you know, here, but certainly there are things that we could do in the Indo-Pacific to reassure allies and in South Asia with India that will show that the United States is going to stay engaged if the administration sees fit to do it. There's a danger that they may be so focused on domestic issues because they've got big infrastructure package up. They've got, you know, lots of spending plans If they don't want to pick fights over national security, they might just say, okay, well, just, you know, let it go. And that will have very deleterious consequences in the long run, in my view.
And if you think Afghanistan's a mess and a forever war, Pakistan is a forever mess and a forever challenge, and morally complicated too, because you're working with people who have, you know, done things that have damaged us and provide safe havens for people killing our troops and so forth. So, I mean, an administration that doesn't have the stomach to handle the Afghanistan issue, will it have the stomach to really do what you might want to do, might have to do in terms of, you know, real diplomatic plus covert plus maybe overt military relationships, engagements, threats within Pakistan and at its borders? I mean, that would be it's a bad, yeah, the message that if it gets messy, we're not quite up to it is sort of a bad message for a superpower to send, I'm afraid.
I think that's right. I mean, Pakistan, in some sense, has been a failing state since partition in 1947. Yeah. You know, it's an interesting thought experiment. If you think about Pakistan and the mess that it is, you know, has been and is, and you look at all the progress India has made, you know, over the last, you know, 30, 40 years, and you wonder, you know, what would this whole place look like had you not had, you know, partition and the creation of Pakistan.
That's a whole different discussion. That would be, we can do our counter history, counterfactual discussion. It is a difficult part of the world. Well, I'm sorry this hasn't been a more encouraging conversation, but I think it's very important. I mean, to be honest and candid, and this is your judgment, and I very much share it, about the risk we're now facing, and it's happening in real time. We're talking here on what, Thursday, July 8th, the withdrawal has mostly happened and is happening. And, you know, and as we've tried to say, I think you've tried to say, as a responsible former senior official in state and defense departments, you know, there are things you can do to mitigate the damage. And I do think there, the tone, not just final thing, the tone of which the Biden administration addresses this is not unimportant. I mean, it's what the president gives a speech in which, look, this was very difficult, and I'm proud of what we did do, and we're not, this does not mean we're turning our back on anything, and we're in fact very engaged in the region, and I'm meeting with the Pakistani prime minister next month, and I'm the Indians, and I'm, yeah, that's sort of one.
I just met with Ghani, you know, we're, yeah, going to support him.
Yeah, one, that's one sort of message to the world. The other of kind of, it's great we got out of there and thank God, washing our hands of it. What were we doing all those years? And I'm very sorry for the sacrifices, obviously, of the troops, but, you know, we didn't do anything. We didn't accomplish anything. We didn't buy anything, which is certainly the rhetoric of some people about Afghanistan. Not to be fair, I don't think the administration mostly. I think it's pretty important, don't you think, how, where on that spectrum they end up sort of in terms of the message they're sending.
Even if you agree and support the idea of the U.S. getting out, as my colleague at Johns Hopkins, Seiss, and former Foreign Service colleague Carter Malkasian does, he has a piece in Politico, I think it was yesterday, about, you know, what Americans didn't understand about the war. It's a very thoughtful piece. I don't agree with all of it, but I mean, because Carter ultimately thinks we should get out, and I obviously don't. But he's very good about saying, look, there was a lot that was accomplished. You know, this was very complicated. It was, as I said at the outset, the task that we undertook was, you know, Herculean to begin with. And one of the things I think that perhaps, you know, and I don't want to be partisan about this, I think, you know, across the board, political leaders on both sides of the aisle have maybe not stressed enough to the public that, look, this is a very, very difficult undertaking. This is one of the poorest countries in the world. You know, to get them on their feet is going to take a long time. But, you know, we still have troops in Germany. You know, after World War II ended in 1945. We still have troops there. You know, the Korean War ended in 1953. We still have troops in Korea. And there, you know, in my view, is no reason why we couldn't have continued to have for a number of years troops in Afghanistan to try and hold the whole thing together, to keep it from, you know, the kind of worst consequences that we're fearful are going to befall based on this conversation.
There were international troops for a long time in the Balkans, and maybe there still are. I'm not even sure. It's so low profile, one doesn't even keep track, or I don't. But and that was a messy intervention. But you know what? A lot of what you achieve in foreign policy is stopping something really bad from happening, both in terms of the actual effect on people, ethnic cleansing and genocide there, but also in terms of its potential ripple effects. And you don't stop them forever, perhaps, but you at least buy time to, so other things can change. And but
I mean, and we have stayed in South Korea. South Korea was a really dirt poor country in 1950 when the war broke out, and certainly after the war in 53, 54. Now it's, the 11th largest economy in the world. So, I mean, yes, and it takes a long time, and a lot of what you're doing, as you were saying, in national security policy is not solving problems, because a lot of these problems don't really have a solution. What you're doing is trying to manage them in the best possible way that leaves you in the most advantageous position. And that's what I think we're giving up here.
Well, let's hope, despite the giving up, that we can recoup and manage as well as we can. And you'll be providing advice to the administration, I'm sure, both privately and publicly, about how to do that. And let's hope this doesn't go as badly as it might, but it's very important to have clear eyes about what could happen. So, Eric Edelman, thank you very much for this discouraging, but I hope, I think, informative and helpful, I think, to our fellow citizens, discussion about Afghanistan. And thanks for joining me again, Eric.
Thank you, Bill. I hope our next conversation is slightly more uplifting.
Yeah, me too. And thank you for joining us on Conversations.